yourself green.
Hello, this is Ed Cohen, editor of Global Business News, and your broadcast host on Global Radio Talk Show, coming to you today from Amsterdam, as well as San Diego, California. Our very special guest today is Mr. Ian Ormesher, Senior Vice President, Global Human Resources for Mead Johnson Nutrition. And our theme of this discussion today is building new capabilities across borders. Ian Ormesher joined Mead Johnson, recently based in Amsterdam, Netherlands. He oversees the people agenda across the company's operations in Asia, Europe, Latin America, and North America. He's a truly global citizen. He's developed an acute appreciation of other cultures, how to build effective businesses and teams within them. Ian was born in the UK and grew up in Singapore and has since lived and worked in, get this, Germany, Canada, Hungary, China, Italy, Switzerland, Hong Kong, Denmark, and now the Netherlands. Let's welcome Mr. Ian Ormesher.
Hi, Ed. Nice to speak to you. I'm getting dizzy thinking about all those places.
Well, you must have so many memories and so many experiences.
Yeah, it's been quite a ride, I have to say.
Okay, so this is all about people, isn't it? It's all about the people.
Yeah, it is. I mean, I think when you work in large global companies, you've really got to work extra hard to understand what makes them tick and how they fit together and how you can make the best of the resources that you've got in the company to do the work that's being required by the corporation.
So tell us a little bit about the company, Mead Johnson Nutrition.
So it's an old company, 100-odd years old, formed by Edward Mead Johnson, who basically had a child that had a serious feeding problem, and he became interested in the subject and then developed a business which is all about pediatric nutrition. Since then, the company's grown a lot, was essentially a U.S.-based company for many years, but more recently that's changed. And the revenues of the company, 70% of them come from outside of the U.S., and we have a big business platform across Latin America, Asia, Europe, and of course, still very important to us, the business in North America.
And so this is a global orientation, but it's all local, isn't it? Everything is local, not only the local cultures, but the local tastes and traditions.
That's right. And I mean, of course, you know, people are having children all over the world and they're concerned about their welfare and their well-being and basically feeding them appropriately. But the reality is that we are serving local consumers and local customers and delivering our products all over the world. And of course, those products vary slightly to meet the local needs.
Well, before we get into discussing HR and the science of HR and maybe HR transformation, tell us a little bit about yourself.
As mentioned, I was very, very lucky to move abroad at a very young age and really have never stopped traveling since then. So I think growing up abroad and actually living abroad does change your perspective when you're working in a global enterprise. I think it's one thing, you know, traveling on an airplane for a couple of days, staying in a hotel. It's another thing queuing at the post office or going to the local shops and just trying to live your life how the local people live their lives. I think it gives you much greater insight into how the thing just works out. So, you know, I started off in the military, actually, where I served abroad in Germany and in Canada. But most of my travels have been through business, working both in emerging markets in typically Central and Eastern Europe, Latin America and Asia. I also have done my time in Africa. And I think when you look at that and you in a global enterprise that also has mature businesses, how you make that work when you've perhaps got very mature ideas and resources in some countries, typically where the head office is, and something that's not quite so sophisticated or not quite so mature, but potentially has huge growth potential in some of the other locations. And I find that marriage of ideas and challenge to be pretty exciting.
You weren't always in HR. You've been in the business side of things, correct?
That's right. I mean, throughout my career, I've always had an interest in business. I actually started off running a restaurant when I was a student. But during my time in what's essentially been in the beverage industry, I've also had roles in sales and in marketing. And I headed up marketing capability globally for SAB Miller for a couple of years, a few years ago now.
we're talking about now building new capabilities in organization development. And so the role of HR, from your view, is not pushing paper and taking care of people's benefits. It's a people management, workforce management overview, while still taking care of the everyday things. Isn't that correct?
Well, I think that's right. And I mean, I think the important thing is the everyday things are important. The function doesn't get permission to do other things if it doesn't get the basics right and doesn't deliver on a day-to-day basis. You know, you'll never buy something more from somebody when the first thing they sold you didn't work properly. And it's the same principle for HR. So, yeah, you know, in every sense, you have to do the basics right. But then I think, you know, when you overlay that, what's needed most of all in most global businesses, you know, is the things to do with building capability, growing talent, establishing culture, and ensuring you've got an engaged, you know, workforce. And I think the capability building is very, very topical. And, you know, HR, I think, plays an important role in supporting line managers and local businesses to ensure they get the best out of their people, configure those in the right way, develop them in the right way, and having the right, you know, enabling systems, processes, or whatever it is, you know, that needs to be in place to make that work. But I think most importantly, you know, it's about having a holistic approach to that and marrying all the parts in the right kind of order. And of course, you know, once you touch those types of things, you're also talking about change. So actually, to your point, it's really around also supporting the transformational change that's required to somehow embed these things into the everyday work routines.
I'd certainly like to learn more about adapting local talent for global business. That's, of course, a hot topic these days, particularly with the millennial and younger people and people from high potential regions, high potential countries, as well as the more developed countries. So what are your thoughts about building the HR function across borders?
Yeah, I mean, I think what's interesting, you know, is, I mean, I, you know, started off my career working in emerging markets in the 1990s. And I mean, I think the first comment to make is that, you know, the universities in some of these countries was not producing talent in some of the functions that we would have wanted, you know, particularly in marketing and particularly actually in human resources. So there just was not a throughput of people, the raw material that you would want to work with. So inevitably, you started off with your own internal education process to basically get the foundation. So you were running, you know, foundational programs to get the core ideas into those people that were joining the company. And I think what you quickly realize is where some education has occurred, done by other people, they all have a slightly different spin on the words that are being used. So on that basis, you know, the first thing to do is really develop a kind of common language, a common set of values or beliefs around what you're trying to do, turn those into some kind of principles, which they could then be used to underpin what people are doing. I think if you don't do that, we are in danger of just teaching people a vocabulary which they use, but actually you end up with 20 people in a room from 20 different countries. They're all using the same words, but they all have an entirely different understanding of what that means or what it would be, what it would mean to actually implement that inside the business.
So we're talking about building new capabilities inside organizations in different areas, in different countries, in different cultures. To what extent do you bring people together personally, face-to-face, in order to build rapport and increase understanding?
Yeah, it's a great challenge in the modern business because technology enables so much. But I have to say, I personally have a view that people don't share and communicate with people that they don't know and they don't trust. So I think inevitably you are bringing people together for a certain period of time in order that they can work effectively together. And it really talks to my earlier point. If you've allowed them to have a different language and a different understanding, when you bring them together, it's really inefficient initially because they basically, you know, spend the first few hours trying to understand what everyone else in the room means. So I think, you know, having that common foundation of language and beliefs that you can do offline, when you bring people together to work together, they're highly efficient. And of course, they produce much better outputs in the time that's available. Arguably, you need to bring them together less frequently. But I think my view is it's very, very beneficial to bring people together, even when technology would suggest you can use technology, exploit it fully. But I think in building trust and relationships, my experience would suggest it's good to be in the room together for at least some of the time.
Let's drill down a little bit. When you're building new capabilities, therefore, where do you start and how do you sequence your actions in order to gain a maximum return or impact?
I mean, I think it really depends on the size of the change that you are actually trying to implement. I think HR people are often in danger of over-engineering things. And so I think, you know, we should strip things back to a very, very simple level and sequence them. And normally, you know, you're building off a need that's been identified by someone. And it can start in different places. So it could be someone's got a piece of new technology, and that's really the key driving force. It could have been a change in strategy or a change in vision, or someone seeing a new business opportunity that you're going after. So you can start in different places, and those places are, you know, established for different reasons. But the way I look at it is there's four or five elements to this which are kind of sequential, and ideally, you know, go in the order of some form of alignment and leadership. So people being very, very clear on what the prize looks like, what's trying to be achieved, basically some sense of, you know, why you're doing that. And that sounds pretty simple. But I think, you know, very often we go into these things, those things are not aligned, they've not been established, and then people start to ask questions halfway through the implementation, when in fact those questions and those concerns should have been tackled as far as is possible, and it's not always possible, but as early in the journey as you can. Inevitably, then, you're going to have a look at whether this is, again, depending on the size of the change, whether there's some kind of structural impact, some organizational design work required, or whether you're just simply talking about some different ways of working, how people are going to work together across borders or across business units or territories or geographies or whatever it might be. But basically, when you're looking at that organizational design piece, what you're really trying to land on is the capacity that you're going to need to deliver this thing. And that might be something that ramps up over time or something that you need a big hit initially. But that capacity combined with the competence of the people within that capacity is basically giving you a sense of the engine that you're going to need for whatever change it is you're driving. And then finally, you know, it's probably going to be enabled by something, a change in a process or change in a system or change in technology something else that's going to be enabling a toolkit or some new training often, you know, will be in that mix. And, you know, when you think about those elements all together, you just got to get them in the right sequence and order. So even if it was driven by a technology change, doesn't mean to say that you shouldn't go back to the beginning, think about the leadership alignment, think about those key stakeholders and what they're saying to the business when you're basically launching on that new journey.
So if I can just circle back for a second, you kept using the word capacity. So in deference to a variety of our listeners and readers out there in the world, what do you mean by capacity?
Well, capacity is just having the number of people that you need to deliver, you know, a job. So let's assume that this is a new product launch. You're basically going to enter a new channel. So you've not been delivering in that channel before. You've not been selling in that channel before. You've done your landscape of how many outlets and how quickly you want to expand your sales effort in that particular area. You know, there are 10,000 stores you could potentially call on. How many sales people do you need to call on those 10,000 stores? Are you going to call on all 10,000 on day one? How many sales people would that require? Or are you going to ramp up over a couple of years? And clearly you could add to your sales team as the sales came through. So capacity is really just about the numbers of people, but obviously numbers are not everything. It's combined with the competence of those people. Are they equipped to sell into that particular channel? You know, what are the new challenges? A bit like the difference between when salespeople would call on, you know, traditional outlets, small shops. It's a very big difference when you're asking people to call on the big grocers with their sophisticated buying models and so on. So a different capacity and a different capability. And, you know, hence they probably needed different enabling tools, systems, you know, EPOS data or whatever it might be that would help them do their job.
So from a strategic point of view, going down to more of a local, operational, tactical level, one size doesn't really fit all when you're operating on a global scale. Everything is global to local, if you will. Of course, you have to be flexible. So it sounds like, please correct me if I'm wrong, but it sounds like you have a built-in system of coaching and mentoring lower-level managers to, you know, say, monitor actions and monitor results, because it sounds like you really need to be flexible.
No, I think that's right. I mean, I think that there's a very delicate balance to be struck, and I think this is where the rubber hits the road and the skill really is. You know, on the one hand, you want the convenience of something that you've got at scale, the convenience of that common language, those common beliefs, and those common principles that basically take everybody in the same direction. Clearly, the speed with which you move through whatever journey you're on will vary depending on the maturity of the organization, the local capability that you have to implement. But to your point, the real issue is around the how the thing gets executed, and the thing will get executed in very different ways in different sorts of cultures because of the environments and so on. I think what's important is that you keep your eye on the prize of what you're trying to achieve and just accept that it might take longer in some cases. If you don't want it to take longer, you need to spend more time building what I would call your enabling capability. So the engine of people, the champions, the people with mastery who are basically going to accelerate your journey towards that goal. And that's really, I think, what you're alluding to when you're talking about managers on the ground. So it's really around the executional capability that you're building. It's one thing having people in a head office designing stuff. It's really another thing in having the right capacity and this competence to actually make those changes locally. And, you know, I think the good companies invest time and energy in really understanding the size of the engine, this enabling capability on the ground, because really that sets the right level of ambition of how quickly you can move and how big a change you can make in a certain period.
Our theme here is global HR, global human resources, and building new capabilities across borders. And we're talking with Ian Ormischer, Senior Vice President, Global Human Resources with Mead Johnson Nutrition. And you're based in Amsterdam. So you mentioned that Mead Johnson is basically an American company, but global. And so may I ask you this question? You're based in Amsterdam. Is that to get closer to Asia Pacific?
Amsterdam is a very convenient location for us. Half of my team sits in the U.S. and half of the team is essentially spread over the four continents. And so, you know, I'm based here at the moment in order just to optimize the way that I work. So, you know, mornings are U.S.-centric, mornings are Asia-centric, and evenings and afternoons are U.S.-centric. So it's efficient from that point of view. And, you know, we're trying to basically use our resources intelligently across the group. And, you know, we have leaders, of course, in our business in the U.S., but we also have leaders in all the places that we operate.
So let's talk about a global war for talent. Is this just a Hollywood kind of a name? Is there something going on that you can tell us about? Is there really a war for talent on a global basis?
Well, I think everybody's looking to have the very, very best people working for their organization. I think that makes sense. And, of course, you know, everybody knows that if you basically grow the people rather than having to buy them in, maybe they're going to be more loyal to you, but also, you know, you get more of a return than you would if you're paying a, you know, absolute premium to bring people in from the outside. So ideally, it's great to find the right people early on and grow them in the organization. There's no doubt that, you know, certain locations in the world are extremely competitive, and people need to believe in your company and believe in what you're doing, or, you know, they will, you know, potentially leave you quite quickly for other opportunities. So I think there's a war, if that's the right word, to attract people. There's also a war to ensure you do the right thing by people and provide the right opportunities of development and growth and promotion, you know, for people. Make sure they're working in a culture that they appreciate, that they're working with colleagues that they appreciate, and on that basis they stay with you and remain engaged and buy into, you know, what you're trying to achieve as a company. So maybe war's a not the right word, but there's certainly competition out there for good people. And, you know, every company, ours included, is very keen to do the right thing to make sure we get the best people we can and hang on to them.
So about cultures, in some cultures, all of this doesn't really work so well, or you maybe it is on a strategic level, but on a on the ground level, is that correct? I'm sure it's correct, but can you get into it with us a little bit about local cultures and how all of this doesn't work or does work?
Yeah, I mean, I think, again, you know, a lot of our business models can be built on individualistic type parameters, and that works well in some places, and it doesn't work so well in other places where people are much more happy to be in a community, don't want to be singled out as an individual. So that's just one example of where things like performance management systems come into some difficulty, and some of your reward systems come into difficulty. You know, if in some parts of the world you say, you know, congratulations, you've been selected for an executive program, and, you know, they'd be very proud and pleased that had happened. In another culture, someone would say, I don't really want to be singled out. Can I go with all the people in my team? And it would not necessarily be seen as a, you know, a positive message, because they potentially could be isolated. So I think, you know, when you're working at a strategic level, I think you have to focus on the end game and the output, and allow the local people to work through the cultural messaging and the cultural steps and do it in the right way. So I think, you know, when we're setting objectives for ourselves, I think we paint a very good picture of what good looks like and what the prize is, but we leave the thousand steps in the journey to be handled and managed locally, where there's clearly much more of that understanding.
If I can ask you about the world, the world's big, but let me ask you, how much, in your opinion, and this is a little bit out of the box, how much, in your opinion, does the rising middle class in, say, Indonesia, in Brazil, Mexico, certainly in China, South Korea, you know, these people are getting educated and they're learning multiple things, including probably English as a second or third language, but they have their own cultures and their own backgrounds, their own basic religions, their own traditions and customs. Are you thinking of moving people from one culture to another? In other words, the mobility of talent? Are you trying to keep people in the same place?
No. I mean, I think as a global company, I think when you're attracting talent into your business, you have to offer careers that people want. So I think it's true to say that a vast number of people, regardless of their class, are very comfortable for various reasons to stay in their local company. And in fact, it can be a turnoff if you say to them, the only way you'll be able to grow your career is by having a global career. So you have to have steps in place, systems in place, a commitment locally to grow people locally. On the other hand, in some cultures and some countries, it's very attractive to have the possibility for international mobility. And so for that community of people, you have to offer that too. So you have to be able to show examples of where you've done it in the past, how you do it, and why it would make sense for them to join, you know, your business and make those moves with your business. So Mead Johnson, you know, we're trying to cater for both of those communities. And it's clear, you know, there's some great countries out there with lots of people who are very keen to be mobile, and we're keen to meet them and to try and help them.
Excellent. Thank you. Now, finally, if I can ask you about the people, because your company is all about healthcare and nutrition and about people. To what extent are you giving back, if you will, training populations in hygiene and that are not necessarily your customers right away, but certainly could be someday, but more or less on a corporate social responsibility basis, giving back to communities that don't know about eating more greens or and less whatever, you know? To what extent is Mead Johnson and your policies working that way?
Yeah, so I think we do a number of things from slightly different directions, Ed. I mean, I think the first thing that we do is we have a pediatric nutrition institute which runs on in three science centers across three continents. And basically that's informing our understanding of nutrition and nutritional needs. And we're able to basically use that science to help work with healthcare professionals to help them understand and advise them. So I think that's one thing which is a very important part of the business and how it works. The second thing is, of course, the business attracts people who are interested in this. You know, the number of people that I meet who basically join the company who have talked about their own children and their own children's feeding issues and problems, which has somehow inspired them to come in and work for us. And so, you know, we do have a large portion of the community inside the company who is very aware of those issues and challenges and gives time and energy to support some of the CSR campaigns that we're involved in. I was in Mexico City last week and basically was hearing about a project that we're involved in there where we basically support and provide nutrition for children who otherwise would be living on the street and wouldn't have access to it. So, I mean, I think the company has a conscience, and of course we contribute all over the world, you know, where we operate and try and help where we can.
Thank you very much, Ian Ormesher, for being my special guest today on Global Radio Talk Show. I invite you to consider being a speaker at one of our conferences someday and perhaps coming back again on a specific topic.
It's been an absolute pleasure, Ed, to talk to you, and we'd love to have the chance again. Thank you so much.
Thank you. This is Ed Cohen, editor of GlobalBusinessNews.net, signing off now from San Diego, California.
I think to myself.